This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome. This is the Vanity Fair Hour. I am Susan Durfee. We're starting with the May issue today, and our first article is about the recent White House Correspondents' Dinner by Charlotte Klein. Glitzy parties and Gaza protests collide at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. It was another long, boozy weekend in Washington, though one accompanied by stark reminders of war and the stakes of November's election. Still, the glasses raised to the Fourth Estate offer a rare moment of respite for this industry, says CBS's Robert Costa, because we're covering a convulsive moment in America. Guests arriving at the Washington Hilton on Saturday night were met with a different kind of welcome committee this year. Shame, shame, shame on you, a crowd of pro-Palestinian protesters chanted as a procession in tuxes and gowns made their way into the gala. You don't have to go in. Shame on the media for allowing 137 journalists in graves, they screamed through a megaphone, referring to one estimate of deaths so far. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 97 journalists and media workers have been killed since the war began. Some protesters accused attendees of being complicit in enabling genocide, approaching guests as they got out of their cars to ask them why they weren't boycotting the annual event. Some of the demonstrators staged a die-in protest of President Joe Biden's support of Israel, demanding he do more to protect lives in Gaza. As protests sweep college campuses across the country, it was perhaps inevitable that activists would descend upon the White House Correspondents Association dinner, the anchor of a four-day blitz of cocktail receptions, brunches, and late-night parties celebrating the Fourth Estate. The flurry of festivities offered an opportunity to get within earshot of policymakers and influential members of the press. Protesters were also on hand the following morning outside the Georgetown home of Robert Albritton as the former Politico owner hosted a Swiss-themed brunch for a who's who of political and media elite, including Attorney General Merrick Garland, Senator Amy Klobuchar, CNN CEO Mark Thompson, and ABC News Chief Washington Correspondent Jonathan Carl. I didn't see any protesters over at CNN's Sunday brunch, which included top anchors like Wolf Blitzer and Caitlin Collins, as well as guests such as Trump advisor Jason Miller. Well, they haven't found us yet, said one attendee. Throughout the long, lavish weekend, journalists, politicos, and celebrities mingle in the backyards of palatial Washington homes, ivy-ensconced hotel courtyards, and flashy restaurants. There's a steady stream of bao buns and sliders being passed and glasses filled with white wine. The whole weekend is the same small talk with the same people, just different catering, political strategist and former Obama aide Eric Schultz told me. But this is our one weekend to put aside the weighty, often intractable issues that consume our days and nights and relax a bit, often with those who we are usually sparring with. Making it a bit harder to relax this year, though, is the looming presidential election and the possibility that Donald Trump, who has mused about throwing journalists in prison and called the press, quote, the enemy of the people, unquote, is back in office this time next year. His allies haven't been shy either about suggesting that journalists could be targeted in a second term. While Trump was famously mocked at the annual dinner by his predecessor, Barack Obama, he skipped the soiree as president. Joe Biden, in keeping with tradition, roasted black tie-clad journalists who packed into the Hilton ballroom, while also urging them to, quote, rise up to the seriousness of the moment and focus on what's actually at stake in the next coming presidential election. or the cage match rematch, as former Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway dubbed the race earlier at a garden party. In 2024, there's a massive hidden undercover Trump voter, and it begins with the mainstream media. They don't like him, but they can't quit him, she told me, suggesting reporters are, quote, so bored and demoralized by the Biden administration that the mainstream media is going to secretly vote for Donald Trump and get him back in there for four more years. Media outlets did enjoy a Trump bump during his tumultuous presidency, evident in the increased subscriptions and big TV ratings. Trump is a one-man stimulus package for the entire industry, as one reporter put it to me over the weekend. It's unclear, though, if a Trump victory in 2024 would similarly be a boon to the news business, which has been plagued by mass layoffs, closures, and audience fatigue. So far, Americans haven't been tuning into politics this election cycle, essentially treating the Biden-Trump rematch as, well, a rerun. The truth is, people read about him whether he's going to be president or not, New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker told me when I asked him whether he suspects some in media see a Trump win as good for business. I hope not, Crooked Media co-founder and former Obama speechwriter Jon Favreau said when I asked him the same question. Maybe I've gone too far from here too long, but I'm no longer that cynical to think that that's true, he told me. Baker and Favreau were among the guests Thursday night at the Riggs Hotel, where Puck and WME were co-hosting an event. Former Speaker of the House John Boehner was in attendance, as was CNBC President Casey Sullivan, MSNBC host Simone Sanders Townsend, civil rights attorney Sherrilyn Ifill, Hollywood mogul and Biden campaign co-chair Jeffrey Katzenberg, senior Biden advisor Anita Dunn, and West Wing creator Aaron Sorkin, who later recorded a live from D.C. version of The Town podcast with Puck's Matt Belloni and Peter Hamby. Another guest, Joanna Coles, remarked, who would have thought that we would have an American president with the words porn star, hush money, and first criminal trial ever of an American president? I think that we in the media understand that these are exceptional times. I next headed to OAS headquarters, where Axios was partnering with Live Nation for a massive party with a security checkpoint to match. I spotted Naomi Biden and campaign spokesman TJ Ducklow online, and once inside, caught Axios co-founder Jim Van Hise's speech, the first minute of which mentioned the site's smart brevity style. Another former Speaker of the House, a linen-clad Paul Ryan, was rocking out to Jelly Roll, the country singer who gave a surprise performance. I grabbed some chicken tenders and called it a night. On Friday afternoon, I swung by the St. Regis, where Punch Bowl News was having a midday cocktail party. An orchestral version of Hotel California played as cabinet secretaries, White House aides, and various members of the business and media industry made small talk. I found bao buns and white wine, naturally, as well as CNN's Abby Phillip, who was getting ready to do her show that night. Does she feel like people are paying attention to the fact that a former president is on trial? By the look of these parties, no, she said. People are too busy day drinking. But this is a respite from the trial. Plus, she added, there's not a damn thing wrong with people just taking a little break and having a good time. The rest of our job is pretty serious. A few hours later, I headed to the CAA party, one of the two big talent agency-hosted bashes that evening. The event was held a block from the White House at the upscale Brasserie La Grande Boucherie, whose recently opened D.C. location is in a 1920s-era bank that sat vacant for years. Saturday Night Live creator Lorne Michaels obliged some fans outside asking for selfies before swanning up the marble staircase. Another SNL star, Colin Jost, the comedian headlining this year's correspondence dinner, was also in attendance, chatting with Scarlett Johansson, who happens to be his wife, and some agents near a life-size bronze lady statue atop a fountain. Nearby were fellow CAA clients Chris Pine, Fallon's sidekick Steve Higgins, and The Daily Show's Jordan Klepper. Klepper seemed lukewarm on the Washington Party circuit. "This weekend is an existential nightmare for many folks," he told me. The opulence of the room, adorned with a gilded ceiling, wraparound mezzanine, and enormous palms and flowers, was not lost on NBC's chief White House correspondent Peter Alexander. "When you go to some of these parties, there's a lot of clients saying, 'Dang, I must be making a lot more money than I thought I was.'" Crisis comms guru Risa Heller was less impressed by some of the outfit choices in the room. "I think you should do a fashion report on what's gone wrong in our nation's capital," she told me. I made a pit stop at Semaphore's party, hosted at co-founder Justin Smith's house in the ritzy Colorama neighborhood, where I ran into Politico columnist Michael Schaefer. "I think if Trump wins again, the psychological reaction will be very different. Last time, it kind of prompted the outburst of resistance energy and people flooding the streets, subscribing to media, all that stuff. And I have a feeling this time it will be listlessness," he said. There was plenty of energy, though, at UTA's annual party, held at the Georgetown seafood restaurant Fiola Mare, and plenty of Biden world folks, including Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates, and First Daughter Ashley Biden, and Naomi Biden. 9 years ago, we started this tradition to celebrate our clients who dedicate themselves to a free press, UTA's Chief Jay Suris told me. "No speeches or toasts. The energy is electric. The line is down the block, and you never know who you'll see on the dance floor." Chef and restaurateur Jose Andres was in the house, as was Bill Nye, sipping a martini near the back of the room. I asked him what he's been up to this weekend. "Networking for the betterment of mankind," he told me. "We're talking about how we're going to use our platforms in media to engage people in the challenge of climate change." "Fair enough. So what's the best thing he's seen all night?" "My wife," he said. Meanwhile, Dr. Anthony Fauci mingled in a black turtleneck. Andrew Ross Sorkin chatted with Mel Barr, and Ben Smith caught up with Klobuchar and Substack's Hamish McKenzie. "I'm always impressed with Amy Klobuchar's pain tolerance for this stuff," Smith told me later. On my way to grab a Bloody Mary, I ran into The View co-host and former Trump aide Alyssa Farah Griffin. "I had to come because it might be the last White House Correspondents' Weekend before Trump is back," she told me. "I've heard people say, listen, if he gets reelected, it might save cable news for another decade. And my thought is like, okay, but what about democracy?" CBS chief election correspondent Robert Costa, who'd brought his dad as his plus one this year, said, "This is a very brief break for me." Costa, who has been covering Trump's criminal trial in New York, "I essentially live in Lower Manhattan now," the D.C.-based journalist joked. "This weekend is a nice time to celebrate journalism and to get together and socialize for a few hours, but we all need to buckle up. This will be a rare party this year, a rare moment of respite for this industry, because we're covering a convulsive moment in America." During the dinner, Kelly O'Donnell, a senior White House reporter for NBC News and the president of the Correspondents Association, spoke about journalists who have been captured, including Austin Tice, who was kidnapped in Syria nearly 10 years ago, and Evan Gerskovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter who has been detained in Russia on bogus espionage charges since last March. Gerskovich's parents were in attendance. O'Donnell also noted the more than 100 journalists who have been killed in the past 6 months of the Israel-Hamas war. Biden did not mention the war during his speech, though he did call on Russia's Vladimir Putin to release Gerskovich. "We're doing everything we can," he said. There are some who call you, the press, the enemy of the people. That's wrong and it's dangerous, Biden told the crowd, adding that, quote, the defeated former president has made no secret of his attack on our democracy. Jost ribbed the president and the press as expected, at one point saying he was honored to be at what might be, judging by the swing state polls, the last White House correspondents' dinner. He also struck a serious tone. When you look at the levels of freedom throughout history and even around the world today, this is the exception, he said, adding, this freedom is incredibly rare, and the journalists in this room help protect that freedom, and we cannot ever take that for granted. Colin Jost had a pretty apt joke tonight when he said this might be the last final White House correspondents' dinner, CNN's Jim Acosta told me. I think people have to think seriously about what's going on right now. Well, maybe tomorrow. So that sounds like it was quite a weekend for the correspondents' dinner. Our second piece is entitled In Vitro Veritas, The Vatican's Secret Role in the Science of IVF. More than half a century ago, men of science and men of faith gathered together to unlock the mysteries of female fertility. The answer? Urine from the brides of Christ. And lo, those nuns gaveth. On a spring day in Rome, 1957, the season of Pope Pius XII's Ash Wednesday Mass, wisteria blooming by the Spanish steps, 30-year-old Bruno Lohnenfeld gave one hell of a presentation. What he said had the potential to shape the course of history in ways even the Vatican couldn't foresee. Inside an imposing L-shaped building that stretched down Via Casilina and then along Via L'Aquila, in a wood-paneled library distinguished by rows of leather-bound books and cream floor tiles spangled with stars, the dozen or so board members of a pharmaceutical company listened as Lohnenfeld described his findings. For 4 years, he had been developing a therapy that would induce ovulation in women struggling with infertility. What he needed now was the support of the Instituto Farmacologico Sirona, whose own staff scientist, Piero Donini, had been working on a similar endeavor and who had facilitated Lohnenfeld's trip from Israel to Rome. The men listened politely, but at the end of the presentation, they told him with regret that they couldn't help. They believed certain hurdles to be insurmountable. It seemed unlikely, for instance, that Serono would be able to procure the vast quantities of one specific essential substance without which the drug couldn't be made. Lohnenfeld left the library. Nearly 70 years later, looking back, he won't be able to remember whether or not he was crying. What he does recall is that a member of the board by the name of Don Giulio Pacelli, pictures will show the Italian prince to have had the strong features and thick dark hair receding sharply at the temples of a Fellini heartthrob, approached him in his despair. Lohnenfeld wasn't Italian or Catholic. He didn't realize the currency of Pacelli's name in a city like Rome, and certainly couldn't have understood his connection to the Pope. Still, the prince had something else to offer, equally potent and instantly recognizable, belief. I have an idea, he said to Lohnenfeld. Let's talk. 30,000 liters. I will tell you exactly the number of nuns we needed for the initial phase, Lohnenfeld says to me. The 96-year-old endocrinologist is calling from his home on the Florida coast in Delray Beach, just a short drive from Boca Raton. He can't immediately find the figures in his files, but he assures me he knows he has it somewhere. I tell him, I recall reading that it was 300 nuns. Could be, he says patiently. Then he locates the slide he was looking for. No, I think we only had 100 nuns. Later, that number would expand, But over the first year, he said, we had 100 nuns recruited, which gave us 30,000 liters, and the 30,000 liters gave us 100 milligrams of the substance which we needed. And this was enough to make 9,000 vials of 75 units, sufficient for 450 ovulation induction cycles. What Lunenfeld is explaining is that it took 100 postmenopausal nuns 1 year to produce 30,000 liters of piss. All that urine, collected and processed by Serono, eventually helped create the drug Pergonol, which aided in the first successful IVF pregnancy in the United States, as well as countless pregnancies in vitro and otherwise worldwide. And in certain ways, it still does. Serono phased out Pergonol in 2004. Later that year, the nearly identical brand name competitor Menopur gained approval for use in the U.S. and remains a leading IVF drug today. In 2022, Menopur turned $802 million in global sales for Swiss-owned Ferring Pharmaceuticals. That fall, changes made in the manufacturing process of Menopur's ingredients caused a year-long global shortage, sending patients scrambling to internet pharmacies and online message boards, desperately searching for vials of the drug. For now, the supply chain has unkinked, at least as long as IVF is legal. In February, Alabama's Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos are people, with a concurring opinion by Chief Justice Tom Parker that quoted scripture. To continue IVF while complying with such a ruling would set assisted reproductive technology back decades. But the ruling is just the latest potential roadblock for a substance that, as Lunenfeld has described it, turned, quote, urine into gold, unquote, on a road dotted at every turn with disparate and powerful men. The G Club. Bruno Lunenfeld was born in 1927 to a wealthy Jewish family in Vienna. His father, David, was a lawyer whose office represented the House of Habsburg, a fierce opponent of Nazism. As Adolf Hitler's influence grew throughout the 30s, David began making plans for his family to escape the country, only to be detained by Nazi forces. In 1938, Bruno, a round-faced 11-year-old with wide, inquisitive blue eyes, joined a kinder transport bound for England. He would later learn that Nazi soldiers forced his father and uncle onto a Dachau-bound transport train, and that his uncle was shot and killed en route, while his father was later moved from Dachau to Buchenwald. While at a camp in Dovercourt, waiting to be placed with a British foster family, Lunenfeld took 10 British pounds secreted into his sock by his mother, bought his own ticket to London, and found a policeman who eventually united him with an uncle living nearby. He attended various local boarding schools until 1940, when members of the French military reunited him with his parents, who had escaped to Mandatory Palestine. It was not Israel at this point, Lunenfeld says, though he never understood how that happened. At school in Tel Aviv, Lunenfeld struggled to learn Hebrew, having been raised on German and then English. Following the Italian Air Force's bombing of the city in September 1940, his parents enrolled him at St. George's, a British boarding school in Jerusalem. Lunenfeld became interested in studying medicine after a close friend died of polio, but Israel had no medical school. He ultimately earned his MD and PhD at the University of Geneva, where, he notes ruefully, he worked in French. For his doctorate in endocrinology, Lunenfeld studied under Hubert de Watteville and Rudy Borth, who were working with the Swiss pharmaceutical firm Ciba to test an oral drug designed to ease the symptoms of menopause. During the clinical trials on patients experiencing vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and brain fog, Lunenfeld and Borth began experimenting with the patient's urine, injecting small amounts into immature mice. Scientists already knew that urine contained hormones, In one early pregnancy test developed in the 1930s, doctors injected rabbits with women's urine, then killed and dissected the animals to examine their ovaries, which developed growths in response to pregnancy hormones. Lunenfeld, Borth, and de Wattenwy hoped that the menopausal urine might hold answers to what caused the unpleasant symptoms. Instead, the injections caused the mice to ovulate and even hyperovulate, in which ovarian follicles develop into not one, but multiple mature eggs. Equally surprising was that after Lunenfeld treated the same menopausal women with a 90-day course of SIBA's drug, which contained estrogen and testosterone, the women's urine stopped the mice from becoming fertile. Lunenfeld and his professors hadn't simply stumbled upon a potential treatment for women experiencing amenorrhea, a lack of menstruation that can mean they're not ovulating. They had developed a contraceptive, too. At the time, the research had limited funds provided by the Swiss government. We had to decide, are we going into the direction of contraception or are we going into the direction of infertility, Lunenfeld says. I was biased, of course. This was just after the war, and so many people got killed. So I thought, maybe the better thing now is to go into infertility and help women who couldn't have babies to have babies. But Lunenfeld, Borth, and de Wattenwy couldn't simply begin injecting would-be mothers with human waste. We had to test biological studies, biochemical studies, biostatistical studies, and so on, Lunenfeld recalls. They didn't have the knowledge or the manpower. At the time, Lunenfeld had just finished consulting on a film for Hoffmann La Roche, now known as Roche AG, one of the biggest public pharmaceutical companies in the world. The producer was a German refugee who'd caught the last train into Switzerland. Over dinner at a Geneva train station with de Wattenwy and the producer, Lunenfeld listed the five people in the world who could help them. The producer made him a bet. That night, Lunenfeld would send five telegrams inviting them to Geneva. If they accepted, de Wattenwy would pay for their travel and accommodations. If they declined, the producer would buy him two cases of his favorite wine, Chateau Neuf de Pape. By the end of the next day, Lunenfeld had received affirmative responses, but all from all but one. The guy from Scotland, he said, was sent by post. In the summer of 1953, Lunenfeld and his advisor had convened a murderer's row of endocrinologists, chemists, biologists, and others to develop standards, assay procedures, and purification methods for this miracle substance extracted from the urine of postmenopausal women. What to call it? The summit landed on human menopausal gonadotropin, or HMG, and they decided to call themselves the G Club. All the urine in the world. Nearly three decades prior to Lunenfeld's research, scientists had discovered gonadotropins, a family of peptide hormones that control ovarian and testicular functioning. They extracted these hormones from the blood of pregnant horses, which could stimulate ovulation in humans when injected. But women treated with these gonadotropins also formed neutralizing antibodies. The urine-derived HMG, which contained a naturally occurring combination of FHS and LH, had no limiting side effect. In a 2004 issue of the Human Reproductive Update Journal, Lunenfeld described the production of HMG as a relatively simple procedure. A chemist mixes menopausal urine with activated kaolin clay, shaken, not stirred. The suspension is left to settle at room temperature and then centrifuged. Liquid is discarded, kaolin is eluted, proteins are washed, acidified, precipitated, filtered, and treated. It wasn't the method of purification, but the means of collection that proved challenging. The average adult produces somewhere around 2 liters of urine per day. It takes about a day's supply of urine from 10 women in order to produce a single therapeutic dose, Lunenfeld told the Silicon Valley-funded nonprofit Israel 21C in 2012. In other words, one New York City water tower's worth would be needed to run clinical trials. To present his findings to Serono that spring day in 1957, the company had agreed to put Lunenfeld up for 3 nights in a very nice hotel, a beautiful little thing owned by the sister of someone in Serono management. But the discussions between Lunenfeld, Prince Pacelli, and Serono's chemist Piero Donini required more runway. For nearly 2 weeks, Pacelli took care of everything, Lunenfeld says, extending his hotel stay with full board for me. Lunenfeld remembers the prince as broad-minded and widely studied. By day, the men talked logistics. In the evening, Lunenfeld joined Donini at his home for dinner, presided over by a white-gloved servant. The head of Serono, Pietro Bettolarelli, and his son Fabio, who would become CEO in 1965, were also present for discussions. A fanciful booklet that Serono produced in 1996, provided by the Merck Archive, paints the story of 7 people sitting around a table discussing the logistics of the proposed project. "I need the urine of thousands of menopausal ladies," an anonymous interlocutor says. "We can collect urine. We will collect urine. We need to collect urine. I need all the urine in the world." "There could be no contamination of pregnancy," Lunenfeld tells me. "The introductions of hormones from even one pregnant person would ruin the batch. In the immortal words of Mel Brooks, send in the nuns." We won't be hearing from these women, the linchpins to this story. Details on their exact location and order are lost to the maw of time, or perhaps buried as a line item in the Vatican archives. The Vatican did not respond to requests for comment on this story. Given their already advanced age at the time of Serono's collection, it's safe to say that none of them are alive today, and few, if any, are likely to have direct familial descendants. A representative from Merck Serono declined to answer questions about the women, citing a lack of documentation. Lunenfeld never met them. Nuns present a special case in terms of memory and representation, since often their beliefs cause them to shy away from both, writes Flora Derunian, a lecturer at the University of Sussex. Her 2023 book, Women's Work in Post-War Italy, includes oral histories of nuns who lived in beautiful apostolic mother houses in Rome between 1945 and 1965, two of which functioned as retirement homes where young novitiates cared for the elderly sisters, likely a similar arrangement to the Casa di Riposo that Serona ended up tapping. Most would have entered the convent at age 18, having relinquished their given names and taken vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They slept in single rooms with a bed and a desk, ate simple meals, fasted on Fridays. They lived regimented days, focused on obedience to the Mother Superior and guided by the tolling of bells. On a call, Derunian describes the communal wardrobes the women shared, from their black and white habits, some of which included a cornet, an elaborate veil pointed almost like an admiral's hat, down to socks and undergarments. "Their individuality was subsumed in the congregation," said Kathleen Sprose Cumming, a professor at the University of Notre Dame who oversees the history of women religious, an academic organization devoted to the study of Catholic sisters. Even so-called, quote, particular attachments, unquote, between nuns were discouraged. In exchange, Sprose Cumming said they received a path to education and protection from unhappy marriages, divorce, and death by childbirth. Not only were they not pregnant, but would never have been pregnant, the vast majority, if not all of them. Serono's donors may have dwelled in the quiet halls of a contemplative convent, which emphasized prayer, or an apostolic one, whose sisters served in such roles as teachers, nurses, or seamstresses. Some made products, herbal medicines, biscuits. Others in Rome cleaned and cooked at the Vatican. The very elderly of all orders spent much of their time murmuring prayers. The structure of convent life would have been at that point essentially unchanged for centuries, said Sprose Cumming. And the convents, she said, were bursting, their numbers nearing an all-time high. If the nuns in 1958 were informed of their new ministry, at a time when everything was on the verge of changing with the birth control pill, they might have seen it as a way to cement the Catholic teaching about how important it is to be open to babies and to have as many babies as possible. According to Lunenfeld, the nuns were Pacelli's fantastic idea. After days of mulling over logistics and behind-the-scenes talks to which Lunenfeld was not privy, the prince took the proposal back to the Serono board, joined by Lunenfeld. He presented the project to them, and then he said, "The Pope is interested." Il Nepotismo. At 5:30 p.m. on March 2, 1939, a puff of white smoke appeared from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel and then promptly turned black. Confusion reigned until, according to Inside the Vatican magazine, the secretary of the conclave sent a note to Vatican radio that regardless of what color the smoke appeared to be, it was white. The cardinals had elected an inside man, the first Roman pope since the 18th century, Eugenio Maria Giuseppe Giovanni Pacelli, took his papal name, Pope Pius XII, on his 63rd birthday. The Pacellis, Don Giulio included, were members of the black nobility, aristocratic families with titles granted by the church and deep loyalty to the papacy. Eugenio's grandfather, Marc Antonio, had served as Minister of Foreign Affairs under Pope Pius IX and in 1861 founded the Vatican newspaper Osservatore Romano. Eugenio's uncle Ernesto had founded the Banco di Roma in 1880, and in 1929, his elder brother Francesco, a legal advisor to Pope Pius XI, had negotiated the Lateran Treaty with Benito Mussolini, which granted Vatican City sovereign independence. Pius XII had a serious look to him, owl-like, with dark eyes made larger behind wire-rimmed glasses. His pale skin, as correspondent Corrado Pallenberg put it in his 1960 book Inside the Vatican, quote, resembled old parchment, yet at the same time it had the surprisingly transparent effect, as if reflecting from the inside a cold white flame, unquote. Pius XII had served as an ecclesiastical ambassador to Germany under his predecessor and was widely believed to have been elected due to his experience in diplomacy. A few days after his election, Pius received a congratulatory telegraph from Hitler. A rather cold and uncommunicative person, Pallenberg wrote of Pius. He did not feel at ease in the Vatican world, 95% of which consisted of easygoing, jovial Italians who enjoyed good food, amusing talk, and a bit of gossip. As a boy, one of Pius XII's favorite games had been pretending to give mass. He surrounded himself with a group of confidants that included his personal doctors, the Bavarian nun Mother Pascalina Lenart, his housekeeper for more than 40 years, and after Francisco died, his brother's adult sons. Plenty of popes kept family close. The word nepotism stems from Gregorio Leti's 1667 book, Il Nepotismo di Roma, or The History of the Pope's Nephews, an often ribald account of the Renaissance-era golden age of popes, granting wealth, titles, and special privileges to their relatives, some of whom were whispered to be secret sons of the popes themselves, as in the case of Alexander VI, a barbarous, lascivious pope who took great delight to be embraced and caressed by fair ladies, whence the number of his bastards was very great. Of Pius's nephews, Carlo, the oldest, was regarded as the favorite. He alone, wrote Pallenberg, had access to the Pope's apartment for private meetings. But all enjoyed privileges, some of which began even before their uncle became the Lord's earthly shepherd. Mark Antonio, the middle brother, presided over a flour mill, a sink and toilet manufacturer, and a real estate and construction empire. The youngest brother was the one and the only Don Giulio Pacelli, a well-known man around the Vatican, as a reporter once described him. In 1940, Pius XII officiated Giulio's wedding in his private chapel. 3 years later, Giulio named his first son Eugenio after his uncle. Giulio was also a lawyer and a colonel in the Noble Guard, a group comprising sons of aristocratic families that saw no active military service, which did not stop him from wearing a uniform of a crisp, dark jacket with gilded embellishments and gold-fringed epaulets, knee-high leather riding boots, a helmet, and a saber. Among his business positions, for which he favored the less flamboyant uniform of a dark suit with a white shirt and tie, Giulio was a representative to the administration of the Propaganda Fide, then the church's missionary arm. A member of the boards of both the Railway Ferrovi di Sud-Est and the Pacelli-founded Banca di Roma, president of the Swiss arm of that bank, vice president of an Italian gas company, papal envoy to Costa Rica, and an executive committee member of Gerardo Cassini Editore, the house that incidentally published the Italian version of L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics in 1951. And for a time, he was the president of a company on whose board he served for more than a decade, Istituto Farmacologico Serono. Land of Milk and Honey. On December 8, 1953, Pius XII celebrated a new pontifical initiative, the opening of the Church's inaugural Marian Year, aimed to, quote, revive Catholic faith and earnest devotion to the Mother of God, that the observant might conform their lives to the image of the same Virgin. The day was a triumph, but a few weeks later, Pius XII suffered a debilitating attack of hiccups, vomiting, and nausea, for which he sought treatment from one Paul Niehans. The Swiss surgeon and former Protestant minister practiced a controversial rejuvenation treatment. At the Clinique La Prairie on Lake Geneva, he injected the buttocks of his famous patients, rumored to include King George VI, Hedda Hopper, and Somerset Maugham, with the cells of fetal lambs and calves, delivered via cesarean section from the bodies of their freshly slaughtered mothers. For the Pope, he made house calls. By the power of God, Niehans's ministrations, or pure luck, Pius XII recovered, only for his illness to fell him again in late 1954. His doctors and nephews arrived at his bedside, believing the end was near. But a week later, the Pope was asking for an egg. Tell him he can have not only one egg, but two, Time reported a gastrointestinal specialist telling his personal physician, and then have them flipped with Marsala if he agrees. Conception, immaculate and otherwise, was much on Pius XII's mind in the final years of his life. The Second World Congress on Fertility and Sterility, for which Lunenfeld's own Professor de Witteveld Watvi was one of 12 committee members, convened in Naples on May 18, 1956, for a 9-day summit. Some 180 paper presentations, excursions to Amalfi and Pompeii, parties and fashion shows to entertain the ladies, and a special pilgrimage to Rome for an address from the Pope. It is entirely true that your zeal to pursue research on marital infertility and the means to overcome it, Pius XII told his listeners, engages high spiritual and ethical values, which should be taken into account. He also said, as regards artificial fertilization, not only is there need to be extremely reserved, but it must be absolutely excluded. A year later, Lunenfeld sat with Giulio Pacelli and Piero Donini, musing over the design needs of the special toilets they planned to install in the convent. They settled on a teardrop-shaped container akin to a small trash can, lined with a plastic bag. Throughout 1958, elderly nuns hiked up their habits, crouched over the containers, and voided their bladders. Serono employees collected the bags of urine and transported them to the Rome laboratory at Via Casilina, where technicians emptied them into metal tanks for processing. By 1959, Serono had harvested enough HMG to begin trials on infertile women. Lunenfeld, back in Israel, where he was working as a visiting scientist at the Weizmann Institute of Science, wanted to treat his own hypothalamic amarenic patients with the drug, hoping to induce ovulation. The head of the hospital instructed Lunenfeld to inject himself with the substance. If he didn't sustain any major side effects, they'd go ahead with the treatment. Lunenfeld wasn't particularly worried about what it might do to his own reproductive health. For one thing, he said already had a son. After the first injection, which an intern administered, Lunenfeld ran a high temperature, an effect of protein buildup in the solution. He and Donini increased purification methods, and Lunenfeld continued to test and burn. On the fifth attempt, they were in the clear. Lunenfeld never patented his findings, which could have made him a very rich man. He says his greatest compensation was the ability to bring the research material and lab equipment to Israel, a gift from Serono. For a short time there, he ran a urine collection program at local elderly care centers, where postmenopausal Israeli women occupied themselves by making baby clothes for the future children their urine would ideally help conceive. In 1962, the first previously amarenic infertile women treated with the HMG gave birth to a healthy baby. Two more women became pregnant, though they later miscarried. Still, this was an enormous success, and the Israeli pharmaceutical company Icafarm, later purchased by Teva Pharmaceuticals, today worth $16 billion, working in conjunction with Serono, registered the compound in Israel as Pergonol. That year, Lunenfeld became the head of the Institute of Endocrinology at Tel HaShomer Hospital, now called Sheba Medical Center. Under his direction, the program grew exponentially, and the institution became a World Health Organization International Reference Center for fertility-promoting drugs. One former research assistant, Danny Lieberman, who performed data science in Lunenfeld's lab in the 1970s, describes him as a paper machine, whose 20-person team published something like 100 research papers in a single year. Lunenfeld says it was more like 80 papers written over a decade. But what particularly distinguished Lunenfeld, Lieberman remembers, was his broad, inquisitive interest in how science functioned within real human lives. He once happened on the non-observant Lunenfeld, kippah on head, poring over the Torah. Lunenfeld had been attending weekly study sessions with a rabbi, in the hopes that he might learn how to better treat the some 20% of his patients who observed the halakha, which places constraints on sexual relations according to monthly menstrual cycles. "I am sad about the suicide which Israel is committing," Lunenfeld says today. During his conscription in the Israeli army, he served under Yitzhak Rabin, who would become prime minister in 1974. The two remained friends. When a far-right extremist who opposed Rabin's signing of the Oslo Accords assassinated the prime minister following what was widely seen as a peace rally, "For me, this was the end of Israel," Lunenfeld said. "It is not what I fought for." The United States granted Lunenfeld a green card in 2001, and for much of the year he resides in Florida, returning to Tel Aviv to visit his children and grandchildren who still live there. His eldest son, Eitan, is professor emeritus at the Teaching Hospital for Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, where he was the head of the OBGYN division and the IVF unit. The Lunenfelds are a part of a long lineage of fertility specialists in Israel, where the birth rate remains substantially higher than that of other industrialized countries. Milk and Honey, Technologies of Plenty and the Making of the Holy Land, 2023, by Israel-born Tamar Novik, a visiting scholar at Humboldt University of Berlin, traces a decade-long Judeo-Christian effort to promote fruitfulness in an unfamiliar climate, from Alsatian Christian missionary beekeepers to dairy farmers during the British Mandate to Israeli scientists, including Lunenfeld, alongside the ways in which knowledge and practices of the Palestinian people shaped European governance and settlement in the region. Novik has a fascination with the science of excrement, plus a wry sense of humor. Taking the Piss and Deep Shit are the title of two recent presentations. Her current project is entitled Fountain of Knowledge: How Science Turned Urine into Gold. In Milk and Honey, Novik writes that with the Industrial Revolution, quote, technology did not replace religion as a colonial device, but instead was blended with aspirations to salvage the land, becoming crucial for seizing control over lands and people. Religion, science, and politics intertwined. Reproduction is such fertile ground to think about in this merging, she tells me. Those three elements are always at play. But what of Lunenfeld's discovery and the drug Pergonol? The fantastic drug. In the beginning, Pergonol did its job too well. A 1965 issue of Life described it as, quote, the fantastic drug that creates quintuplets, unquote, as women in California, New York, and Sweden gave birth to sets of many babies. Urine collectors recruited donors through door-knocking campaigns and made daily drop-offs to plants in Umbria and Benevento. From there, refrigerated trucks transported frozen hormone absorbent to Rome. Soon, Serrano added collection centers in Argentina, the Netherlands, and Spain to the ones in Israel and Italy, with 600 women contributing what could produce 40,000 ampules per year, then enough to treat the worldwide population of hypopituitary hypogonadotropic amaurotic women, i.e. infertile women. The introduction of IVF, for which multiple mature eggs are ideal, and new protocols prescribing HMG to patients with tubal factor infertility increased demand. By 1985, 2,000 women in the U.S. were prescribed the drug. Soon, patients worldwide required 30 million liters of urine. When HMG became part of a protocol in male factor infertility, the number ballooned to 70 million. Lunenfeld turned his own research to male infertility and founded the International Society for the Study of the Aging Male in 1997. In 1995, despite twice daily pickups from 100,000 urine donors, a shortage of Pergonol caused panicked patients to hoard prescriptions. I feel like an addict, one woman told the New York Times. 11 years later, Serrano phased out Pergonol, focusing instead on another fertility product, Gonal F, made from hamster ovary cells, and Ferring released Menopure. Citing proprietary information, a Ferring spokesperson declined to answer detailed questions, including where urine is collected and whether donors are compensated, and sent a statement which read in part, Ferring believes that everyone has the right to build a family and to choose their own path to parenthood. We recognize and work to address diverse family building needs and fertility journeys, including for the LGBTQ plus and single parent by choice communities who use in vitro fertilization to start or grow their families. In February, Pope Francis, who last year reaffirmed the Vatican's anti-IVF stance, addressed the General Assembly of the Pontifical Academy for Life, a papal-appointed body responsible for developing Catholic teachings and positions on topics such as abortion, artificial intelligence, and IVF. For those committed to a serious and evangelical renewal of thought, Francis said, it is essential to call into question even settled opinions and assumptions that have not been critically examined. While the Pope made his address, Lunenfeld and his wife were in the middle of a vacation to celebrate his 97th birthday, beginning with a cruise from Fiji around New Zealand and Australia. From there, he continued to Singapore, where he reunited with old colleagues, including three of Serono's former Singapore-based representatives. At one point during our conversations, I asked him about his own relationship to religion. This is very strange, he says, very strange. He has a hard time defining it. His wife, who's agnostic, calls him religious. He doesn't keep kosher, but he prays every morning. I believe in God because so many things, good things, happened to me. Thinking of the Kinder transport, something must have helped me somewhere, he said. This is something which is troubling me a lot to understand, and there's no way to understand. No small thing for someone whose life's work has been tracking down answers. Everything was miracles. Thank you very much for listening today to the Vanity Fair Hour. This is Susan Durfee for CABVI's Radio Reading Services. Until next time.